Welcome to another virtual interview on Elaine's Literary Salon. I'm your host, Jeffrey James Higgins. I own Elaine's Literary Salon and restaurant with my wife, Cynthia. We've turned it into a literary hub in the Washington, D.C. area. To date, I believe I've interviewed about 170 authors, and I'm super excited for today's interview. Tom Straw is an Emmy and Writers Guild of America nominated writer-producer, New York Times and USA Today best-selling author, and former Mystery Writers of America board member. Writing as Richard Castle, Tom originated the Nikki Heat series, all of which were New York Times bestsellers. Under his own name, he published The Trigger Episode, Buzzkiller, and USA Today best-selling spy thriller, The Accidental Joe. In television, Tom wrote for and produced the original Night Court, which, by the way, is just iconic. What a great show that was. Dave's World, Grace Under Fire, and Nurse Jackie. He also wrote for CBS's Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson. You can read more about him and find links to his work at tomstraw.com. Tom, it's a real honor to have you. Welcome to Elaine's Literary Salon.
Thank you. You know, I've been looking forward to this ever since we crossed paths in Fredericksburg not too long ago. And, you know, it's very interesting to me because there are some people that you just sit with and you have no trouble conversing. So we'll try to live up to that today. But I guess I should ask you, if 170 authors before me, what was your hurry?
You know, it's honestly like this restaurant is my wife's thing. So it's she's a huge foodie and a gourmet cook. And she promised her grandmother Elaine when she was 12, she'd have a restaurant and name it after her. So she's created this beautiful thing, but we have the space, and being able to give like a sort of a safe space and a home for writers in the DC area has been really a passion of mine. And yeah. I talk to everybody from, you know, from first time self-published authors to, you know, many New York Times bestsellers. And it's really just wonderful. There's no way I'd rather spend the day than just chatting with authors.
Well, your reputation precedes you because everybody, when I was in Columbia, Maryland, and in Fredericksburg, and all in the D.C. area, everybody was talking about Elaine's and you. And I have to say how much I enjoyed the speech you gave in Fredericksburg at the Rappahannock Fest.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, I appreciate it. That's a fun one. They get some really fun authors, a lot of readers in there, and I enjoyed yours as well. Yeah, so we've actually met and chatted at two conferences this in 2025.
Yeah.
So that begs a question, like what is the importance of writing community, you know, in general for writers?
I think a great deal. You know, it's one of the things I have to say. You know, I've only been doing books for 15 years now, and one of the things, you know, I always aspired to like see my name in print and to hold the book and all that other stuff. And I was thinking before this conversation with you here, how the unexpected benefit of it was community. I didn't have any idea that being an author, as you rub elbows with people and you go to conferences, and I'm not a huge networker. You know, like I'm not one of those people who's like, got to meet some people, got to get some names on my Rolodex. Remember them, Rolodex?
I did.
But what you're saying is very true, and I find, especially in the mystery community, and I'll include the thriller writers and spy writers in that too, there is a sort of a collegial aspect to it that you don't find in some of the other genres, so I've heard. And, you know, I like to put it this way. It's like you meet another author and you're not competing. It's like you could have the most beautiful garden you could make, and it doesn't diminish my garden. You can have one and I can have one, and we're not in each other. You know what I mean? It really is we're all joined together, and I think the mutual support and rapport and the sort of understanding of the daily battle is bonding.
No, I think you're 100% right. And I interview authors of all genres, and I definitely get that feeling when I chat with them about the other writers and whether you're in competition or actually helping each other. I think deep down, like the mystery, thriller, suspense, you know, people, let's just say kind of all like genre, maybe, you know, horror, fantasy, like sci-fi. I think people have such a love of reading that they want people to create new work. And it isn't a zero-sum game. I mean, people can only read so many books a year. So I guess in a way it is. But yeah. If you write a book that's in my genre and it's great, you might drive people to my books too, you know?
Exactly right. And, you know, there's a lot to be said also for support. It's, you know, helping each other is a big deal, I think. And Also, I would just add to it, not insignificantly, as is the case when I listened to your talk in Fredericksburg, I learn. I mean, I'm constantly learning, and I love being exposed to a fresh idea or even one that I'll reject, but at least it's something input that I'm getting that makes me a little bit, I think, more educated as an author who's constantly learning, I hope.
So when you're like a new writer, would you give like advice to somebody who's maybe at their first book or aspiring, hasn't yet published? What would you tell them to do, to learn, to continue that like ongoing education, to continue making a better product?
First of all, save. Be a good saver. Because actually, I'm joking about that, but you know, it is a very important part of it. Is I often say to new writers, the hardest part of being a writer is staying one, because it is a challenge. It's got its rewards, but they aren't constant, and so you do have to have that sort of foundation of recognizing that it is a life commitment, and that on all phases of it. But I you know, I'm not going to break new ground with this. I would just say read everything you can possibly read. And not just craft books, although they are useful. You know, I have two or three behind me that I keep. They're very shop-worn. You can make soup out of some of them. They're so maybe Elaine's would like to have some of my books.
I see a culinary theme going through, including your last book.
Yeah. Hey, by the way, sidebar, if I can just divert myself. My wife and I are going to the CIA in a week from Friday, the Culinary Institute of America, where we've signed up for a class. So, you know, we're foodies, and I love going to the other CIA.
You know, it's very meta, because you have in your, the accidental Joe, right? You have the CIA reaching out to your chef, asking him to do work for them. Tell us a little bit about that book. That was your most recent book.
Right. This is a book, and it maybe is because it's my most recent, but you know, you always love the newest one, but I'm a runner, as you are, I believe, right? Yes. Yeah. So I was out on a run one day, and out of nowhere comes, well, maybe not out of nowhere, but out of the blue comes an idea. What if Anthony Bourdain had been using his travel and culture and food show to spy for the CIA? Now, I say it didn't come out of nowhere because I'm a huge Bourdain fan. You know, I've seen all of his shows two or three times. I've read all of his nonfiction books, which are terrific. He was a great writer. But it was inspiring to me. And then it was, let me at it. Then it was, you know, first of all, don't forget, you know, I don't carry a pen and paper when I run. So I kept like, I'm repeating, okay, Anthony Bourdain, Anthony Bourdain, Anthony Bourdain. Then of course comes the hard part, which is, okay, you've got an idea. What do you do with it? At first I sat down and thought, well, he's not going to be a real CIA agent or officer. I mean, he doesn't have the discipline for the training. He didn't have the time to do it. So that means I have to give him a handler. So I then came up with, well, how about if it was a woman he had the hots for, and it was mutual. And by the way, he doesn't realize it, but she's been embedded as his producer. So that's where the accidental part comes into the title, is that for an unspecified period of time, his producer has been using his show as cover for some missions. And now they need him to take part, being conscious. And so he's working his way out. He's the sort of the Hitchcock everyman cast into a role where he's over his head and loving it.
It's such a great book. And that's such an interesting story too. But let's unpack it a little, because there's so much in that, what you just said.
I'm on the hot seat now.
So like when I'm really fascinated by writers and creators of all types. And we host other artists here too. You're running, this idea comes to you, right? So it's your mind's wandering or whatever. There's a process to that. But where does this idea come from? Like, it's one, the only one question I ask all my writers is like, where does story come from? Because to me, it seems so magical. You know, like, how does this thing come together to you and just like hit you while you're running?
Well, the important thing for me is I always keep a notebook nearby, because you never know when something's going to drift in and drift out. And I want to tell you, I have maybe 1,000 more horrible ideas. right? So the idea is when you get the one that you think is worthwhile or two, there's a little tuning fork that goes off. And I can't explain it other than to say, you know, and this maybe goes to my TV work in the past, and that you get an idea and you can immediately see where everything goes. And you don't know what the moves are, but there's some instinct that you have based on your experience that this is going to work. I can do this. I can do that. Oh, he can go here. He can go there. This can happen. He can be. And so I'm rambling here, but I guess what I would say is that there is a sort of experienced amateur involved. When you do get that idea, it's like when you started writing and you got your first book idea. And if you have that feeling, that'll keep you going.
And so when you talk about, like, you know, developing the idea after that, so you get that great idea. And I always tell writers, if it interests you, it'll interest other people, right? Like, because we all just love story at the root of this. So when you're developing it, how do you approach it, from the 40,000 foot level? Like, how are you starting with, okay, you've got this character, are you outlining plot? Are you like, how does it initially, when you're saying, will this hold water? Am I going to be able to write a novel on this? How do you put the pieces together?
Going back to my TV thing where, you know, I wrote sitcom before I did all, as you mentioned, Night Court and a few others, you know, TV's sitcom and television generally is really about character. Because, you know, your situation doesn't change that much. That's why they call it situation comedy and so forth. But you're really geared to what characters and how will they interact and where's the friction and where's the open road and all that, where are the obstacles. And so I always go to character first. As I say, I started first examining him. I know a lot of chefs. I know a lot of pretty well-known chefs. And I've also studied a lot of chefs. And so I tried to sort of pick and choose. I didn't want to do Bourdain himself. I wanted to do my version of Bourdain, which in some respects isn't so far from me, because the voice, that's the next thing. The voice of the character is very important. And I made, Sebastian Pike, my celebrity chef, the sort of like a king of wiseassery, because that's me. You know, there's a little bit of Jim Rockford. There's a little bit of... Just the guy who just says what is on his mind without a filter. I'll try to be careful in the next few minutes here.
I wish you wouldn't, because you've got a great sense of humor, right?
But to answer your question, I always begin with character. Then from character, I go for relationships. You know, what are his needs? What are his vulnerabilities? What are her needs? What are her vulnerabilities? And you're always looking for that dynamic tension between those things, you know, something you need and then the obstacle that's before you. And in the book, The Accidental Joe, there's a lot of things that are happening that made it fun and complex, because you're not only dealing with the mission, which frankly was the last thing I came up with. I've got pages and pages of what if missions, but I tried to find the one that not only enabled them to be on a mission together, but one that also opened the door to lots of obstacles, not only in bringing the mission home, but in servicing their relationship and will it last? Because the big question, I mean, forgetting all the interpersonal stuff between them about, you know, he's a wise ass and she's a rule follower and all that other stuff. The big question, the overarching question was, when the mission is over, are they done? And, you know, that's on both of their minds. Like, what are we? I mean, is he going to quit doing television and follow her around as a secret agent? Is she going to stop working for the CIA so she can produce a cooking show? Those are very important questions that I think run to another aspect of examination whenever I'm building something, is what are the universal themes? I think we all have relationships that involve geographic problems, like somebody's in one city, somebody's in another, job promotions that don't sound so good in the family. You know, there's always all sorts of things and pressures. So I wanted to highlight that too in their relationship and bring it down to street level.
You've hit so many like key elements there, right? The universality so the reader can relate to it, but also the personal. Like it's so interesting that you find the plot last. Like often plot idea comes to me first, right? And then I look at character and do what you're doing. And then that kind of needs and of the individual characters. I mean, that's all really important stuff. Yeah. You mentioned voice. How do you balance humor when you're doing like an espionage thriller? Because obviously you're cutting tension every time, and it's very, you're very funny, and the voice is fantastic. Like the voice just sucks me in immediately.
Yeah. Well, it beats the hell out of me. I don't know, but that's not a good answer, is it? Here's an oft-told story, but I'll tell it again. I wrote the first draft of the Accidental Joe in the third person, and in it, I began each chapter whenever he would go to a new setting or new place with a Bourdainish kind of voiceover, kind of a snarky, you know, hey, well, here we are in Nice where Hannibal came through with the elephants, watch your step, everybody, you know, that kind of stuff. And the book didn't get traction. I'll put it that way. You know, my agent said, you know what? People are liking it, but they're not loving it. I said, stop sending it out. And I did a very scary, bold thing, and I do mean it was scary, because you finish the book, you love the book, you want it to go out, and I sat and I did a self-examination, and I said, well, what are people really loving about the book? They're loving the voiceovers. And I'm saying to myself, what am I loving about the book? The voiceovers. And so then that follows why. And the answer is, it's my voice.
How did you get that feedback on that that's what readers were liking?
Just my, you know, beta readers, people, a few friends of mine who had seen it, and they said, boy, the voiceovers really cook. And I thought, I'm going to write the whole book like a voiceover. And so I made the very scary jump to saying, I'm going to sit down and page one, I'm going to reconceive this book as first, not only first person, but first person direct address to the reader. And, you know, you've read the book, so you know it starts when he's in the hospital and he's saying, how did I get here? You know, if you'll come along with me, I'd like to tell you how this happened, you know, and I really tried to make it a letter to the reader. And that freed me so much to just whatever crossed my mind, if it felt right, yeah, say it. And to answer your question about humor, they need to be good roommates. When I was on Nurse Jackie, that was one of the things, I was on that show for 3 seasons, and I began each year in the writer's room by instructing the writers, don't forget that comedy and drama have to be good roommates. And there's a time for the comedian to sit down, and then there's a time for the comedian to give everybody some relief. And if I had to just find a way of putting it in a nutshell, it would be, I try to have the action take their breath away and have the comedy be a way to let them catch it in between.
And where do you, is that balance just coming from your many years of writing, or is it something that you always inherently had? Because, you know, you're right. It's one, the higher the drama, the funnier the humor will become, and vice versa.
Yeah. As long as they are compatible with each other, because I hate it when I don't like spy movies or action movies where, you know, the bullets are flying and nobody's getting hit. Everybody's joking. It's not really, and you know, this is nonsense. It's not real. And so my whole thing is, you know, humor is part of real life, even in tragedy. I mean, how many people laugh at funerals? How many people lose it at a wedding, you know? And, you know, the places, that's what Night Court was about. You know, you had a proscenium where you had a judge, such as he was, and you have a judge, and there's a certain sense of order that you have to have there and maintain. Therefore, the comedy really flies, because it's all against that dynamic tension of the setting. And so what I try to do is recognize that in real life, people do crack jokes once in a while. At the same time, I don't like jokes. I like humor. I like asides. I like somebody saying the unsayable. But, you know, horse goes into a bar and the bartender says, hey, buddy, why the long face? I don't do that. You know what I mean? And I don't do it well. Just hang around me for a while. You see, I can't tell a joke. But I just like to keep it real. And real means make it emotional. Make make yourself care and make the reader care.
Well, I mean, you're spot on with the with like the tension and like, you know, I was a deputy sheriff before I was a federal agent. I spent a lot of time in courts over the years. And I can tell you, I don't think I ever laughed harder or tried not to laugh as hard as I did when I was in court when I was a cop. With the things you see in that tense situation and the hilarious things people do and say, it's just but it's only because of that tension that you're not allowed to laugh.
Right. And, you know, you see it on television, like you see when newscasters can't keep it together because something strikes them funny and like something goes wrong and they laugh. Or, you know, I did the weather on TV for a while in St. Louis. And there were a number of times that I would have to really like stop myself from laughing, or I would get going and the crew would laugh and they would have to stop because you can't have a newscast with the crew laughing.
So when you have this funny voiceover, you're really breaking the fourth wall. I think you do it in the first, definitely in the first chapter. I think it's like the first page and a half or something. And you're saying, oh, like, you know, what happened? And I'm coming and come along with me on this ride. When you're doing that and breaking that fourth wall, how does that impact the tension in your story, like as a writer?
A great deal, because it creates no fly zones. You can't hop around. You can't, you know, the beauty of third person and especially omniscient is that you can cut away and you can have something going on in this room. And then you go to the other end of town and they're having this meeting. And then this is, oh, look out, they're going to collide. And if the story is told through the eyes of the narrator solely, especially in first person, direct address wasn't so hard for me. In fact, I made it a point to not worry about saying, can you believe this is happening? You know, things like that. Because I wanted it to be a letter to the reader. I wanted that relationship. And as you may recall, if you were awake at the end of my speech in Fredericksburg.
It was a great speech. I loved it.
Well, thank you. But it was the 10 lessons I've learned. And the last one is the secret to writing is to advocate for the reader. And so putting myself in the reader's chair is always the thing that rules the day. I read and reread my work as if I were reading it for the first time and didn't know about anything about it. It's very hard to do, but I'm able to do that. And it's amazing what you catch, especially if you read out loud.
So what would you say to writers? And I mean, I talk to a lot of writers every week, and so many of them are, I don't want to say chasing trends, but they're looking at the marketability of what they want to write because it's such a brutal business. And I always tell them, just write a story that's interesting, right? Like what you're talking about, I think that's the same thing. I think you're saying, you know, the reader sitting there to escape, the reader wants to go on a journey. You know, so how do you balance that? Like to play devil's advocate, how do you balance, you know, this is, oh, I love this idea, I want to write this, versus, can I sell this? Can I get an agent with this? Can I take this to market?
Yeah, I'm of the mind that you don't want to commit suicide before you start. You know, you don't want to choose a topic or a genre or an idea that is stillborn. You don't want to have something that isn't going to fly. Having said that, I'm my first audience, and I don't look at the horizon and say, what are they going to want next time? I don't do that because that's hack writing. I think it's like writing for the market. Don't ignore the market. Don't be stupid, because you're going to be spending months on a book. At the same time, if you're playing to the market instead of what's inside you, it's going to be hollow. And you don't want.
Yeah, no, I think that's fantastic advice. You know, so, you know, the Castle series was obviously big for you. How many, did you write four of those books? I can't remember.
Seven, sir.
Seven. Wow. Sorry about that. Yeah, that's fantastic. Well,
can I give you the litany? Can
I wish you would.
Yeah, it's okay. So my first book, The Trigger Episode, was published by a very small studio. I was a TV writer and, you know, had nominations for various prizes and so forth, as you mentioned, but you know, when I started in books, who's he? You know, so I got my first novel published by a small but respected publishing house, and got nice reviews and all that. But they got bought by a German publishing company that didn't want fiction in the, so they just wanted the nonfiction catalog. That means no sequels. So I felt kind of bummed about that. But then the publisher, editor at that house went to Hyperion, which is owned by, was owned by Disney. And he took me to lunch one day and he said, you know, there's a new show coming on ABC called Castle. And I'd seen one or two episodes. It had just come on. And I said, yeah, I like that show. He says, well, good, because here's what we're thinking. Those two characters that you've got in your first book are a lot like, you know, Castle and Beckett. Would you ghostwrite? Because you know, the conceit of the show is that he's a writer looking for his muse. He says, would you consider ghostwriting a book as if you were Richard Castle, not to do their plots, but to incorporate just the character relationship and how? So I met with Andrew Marlowe, who is the creator of Castle, and we had a nice time in our first meeting. He's still a friend now. But what I said is, I don't want to novelize your show. I don't want to take your scripts and turn them into books. I want to come up with my own ideas with Easter eggs in there for people who've seen the show. So I'll shorten this story. I do the first book, and they wanted it to be a one-off, like straight to paperback or whatever, you know, and that's it. So I turn, and they also wanted me to turn in a chapter a week, or you know, whenever I finished a chapter. Mm-hmm. Fourth chapter, the publisher calls and says, you know, we had a meeting and we decided this is a hardback and we want it to be a real book. And I said, well, that's not bad. And so it came on, it went to number 6 on the New York Times.
Wow. It's a big deal.
Yeah. And I didn't have a contract. I didn't even have royalties on that book.
Oh my God.
It was work for hire. You know, I was the gunslinger. I'd leave the silver bullet and move on. But they made a contract for 2 more. And the second one went to number 4 on the New York Times. The third one debuted at number 1 on the New York Times.
Wow.
And so then a couple more, you know, they wanted a few more, please. And so I said, okay. And of course, I had a much better deal and all that. So it was a very, very good to me. It didn't hurt, going back to what I talked about earlier. I had seen the show and I liked it. And I watched every single episode with a pencil and paper and grew to love it. And that's what I would say about your question earlier about marketplace versus what's inside, is that I felt like I was personally thriving as a writer in that world because I loved being in it. They were fun to write. I didn't care that my name wasn't on the cover. I made great friends. I learned a lot doing it. And it's not been a not bad calling card.
Is it hard for you? You say you don't care your name's on the cover. You've got books hitting the Times list and it's all you, right? You're writing these books. That's the novelist. It must feel a little weird, right? That you don't have like, you know, your name writing as or whatever.
Yeah, it is weird. In fact, when I decided I wanted to do, when I finished doing my 7th book and then I did Buzzkiller, I actually contacted my attorney and I said, am I allowed to, in promo, say I was the author of this, this, and this? And he said, he read my contract and said, feel free. So that was a relief to be able to at least capitalize on it. But in the process of doing it, you know, it was a little bit like being Santa Claus and nobody knows it's you. And also, I, as I say, I love the show. I was on it once as a, you know, in a quick cameo. Nathan Fillion's a great guy. I really enjoyed him. There was a whole kind of like excitement about this. They had me on the show because they wanted to say that the writer, the real writer, had been on the show. And of course, they've also had, they had Michael Connelly on. They had, who's that guy? What's his name? Oh, yeah. He's Patterson. Have you heard of James Patterson? He was on it once.
It rings a bell, I think.
Yeah. I'm acting a little bit here. So they wanted to have the guessing game of who really writes these. And somebody asked Nathan at a book signing for my book. Somebody asked, do you write the books? And he goes, no, the books are written by Richard Castle. So there you have it.
So is it must be strange stepping into that world when you're like in an episode and seeing, because you're living in this world, you studied it, you're taking notes, you're writing it, you're creating it. How weird is it to like be there when with the actors and actually living in this moment?
It's very strange, I got to tell you, because the episode I was in was shot on location at a nightclub on the Sunset Strip, or not Sunset Strip, Sunset Boulevard in Hollywood, and so it was actually the book launch of the book, was the occasion for the show, and so there are all the copies of the book out now, and here's a little joke. The first book I wrote, it was in such a rush to get it out because they wanted it very fast. I think it was something like, 240, 250 pages or something like that. And they had the prop books made before the book came out. And so they have these big tomes. And so Andrew Marlowe, the creator of the show, holds up a book and he looks at me and he says, I guess the camera does add 10 pounds, you know?
What a great line.
Yeah. But, that's the atmosphere, but it was weird. You know, there's Nathan, and I'll tell you a little story about him. For our scene, it was the two of us sitting at a table in the book launch party at this club, and it was basically him telling me a joke, and then he gets up and shakes my hand and moves on and all that. And the way it's done in Hollywood is that when you are You run a scene once without cameras. You have the director stand there and everybody rehearses the scene. And then when that's done, they figure out what the director's figuring out what he wants. They call in the second team. And that is all of the paid extras who, like, one wears a sign that says Castle and somebody wears a sign that says Beckett and all that. So that they can go to their dressing rooms and, you know, hang out and watch, you know, play video games or whatever they do. I don't want to know. They call the second team, and Nathan's guy comes over and he goes, that's okay. I'm going to stay here and talk to Tom. And I thought, well, hello, Nathan Fillion. Yeah. How are you? And, you know, he sat, you know, while they did that's when they're doing the lighting and they're, you know, he sat there for like a half hour with me just chatting, you know, and he talked about how when he was on Five Guys and a Pizza or whatever it was called, and how having a hit show is such a thing that he wanted. But he was very gracious, and the fact that the guy who's number one on the call sheet would send away his stand-in and just hang was kind of touching to me.
Such a fun experience. Did you see influence from your books affecting the series, even though your series is derived from the show?
Yeah. It's funny because the second book, Naked Heat, I had an idea to start it, which was to have them come to a crime scene. And the cops come in and it's very tense, and there's word of a gunshot, and they want to come in and see what's going on. And they come in and he's sitting in the kitchen. Like, there's Castle sitting in the kitchen of this place, you know, where somebody had gotten murdered in the next room. And Andrew said, I hope you don't mind, I'm going to use that. So, and he did. Again, like he opened one of the episodes with a version of that. So that feels good. It's... I hope you can tell. It's fun. I enjoy it. It's not like assembly line work. I enjoy the juice.
No, I can tell that, and that's fantastic. Is there a downside to working in somebody else's created universe, like as a creator, that, or because there's so much upside to it, it doesn't really matter to you?
Well, you know, because again, I'll go back to my, you know, dozen years in television writing. I was always in somebody else's universe. So as a novelist, it felt okay. And actually, that's why Andrew Marlowe and I got along so well, because I was a showrunner and he was a showrunner on Castle. So we spoke the same language. We shorthanded. And I'm sure you and your law enforcement and your thrilling spy career also had the same experience, that there are some people that you just kind of mesh with because you have shorthand. You can just, you know, then there's some things that you don't worry about. You just know this is covered. So our relationship was great. In fact, when I would send him half the book and then another half the book, you know, when it was done. I always made sure to send him the first half though. but his notes were so light. They were just like very, they were thoughtful and they were good. I guess the most stunning note he gave me was in that second book. He said, you know, I figured out the killer on the third chapter. He says, you might want to look at that. That's all he said. That was the note. You might want to look at that.
It's a big note. Yeah.
The big note. And I also had a great editor, Gretchen Young, at the publishing house. And so, you know, all around, everywhere I turned, I had support and not a lot of reprimand. You know, it's nice.
So I would never be able to give early chapters to somebody before the project, because I tend to finish and then go back and do a lot of layering and change things. Yeah. Is this an outgrowth of all your work in Hollywood on television, where there's a lot of like communal writing and writers' rooms and a lot of notes back and forth?
Well, my experience in it, although it's changed in some shows, my experience was always the writer writes the first draft and the second draft, and then the room joins in to try to polish it. Some shows now, they're room written, and what they do is they just basically pick a name out of a hat to see who gets the credit this week. I do have another story, if you will, about that first book, because what they wanted to do, obviously I was hired to do a promo book. And so what they decided they want to do is that they wanted the book to be published right at the beginning of the second season of Castle. It was on for a half season and then did a full season, season two on. I made the deal in like April, or it was late April, and they needed it in the fall. And not only that, but here's the onerous part. They wanted to have, they wanted to post a chapter a week of the first half of the book, 10 chapters, leading up to the premiere. And so what I had to do is I had to write a chapter, send it off, and shortly thereafter it was online.
Wow.
And meanwhile, okay, so I'm writing chapter 5 now, and there's 3 chapters already posted. And I told Andrew, I said, I feel like I'm throwing mailbags off a train. You know what I mean? It's just like one of those crazy things. Like, okay, there it is. And then I reached a point, and you'll relate to this, I reached a point where I was like getting to chapter 18, like I did 20 chapters in that book. I'm getting to chapter 17, 18, and I'm realizing, oh no, I've written myself in a corner. And I'd already published, you know, the first 10 chapters. And so I had to repurpose some clues. That's how I would put it.
That's so interesting, because a lot of times, like writing mysteries, you will go back and then insert the clues or change things to make it work, right? And people are like, oh, how did you know at the beginning? But you didn't. You knew at the end. I don't think I've ever heard of an author who had those types of constraints on them. That's really tough. How did that change you as a writer?
Hugely. Especially because I had a day job. I was working on the Late Late Show with Craig Ferguson then. So my day was I would have to be at the conference table with Craig and the other writers at 10 a.m. at CBS in Hollywood, and come up with the monologue. What's it going to be? What are the topics? Okay, and we want to do a Prince Charles sketch, or we want to do a Harry Potter sketch. You know, who's going to write it? Okay, you write, and then you're just blazing writing all day. Revisions, jokes get thrown back. We need a better one here. Then there's the rehearsal, and then there's the sketch, and you know, sometimes you're in the sketch, so it's a very busy day. The show's over and there's no post-production. You're on camera at 5 o'clock, the show's done at 6, you're out the door. I'd grab dinner, I'd get to the apartment I was renting out there, and I would sit down at 9 o'clock at night and start writing the Castle book. And I would go till 2 a.m., sometimes 3, go to bed, get up, and then hit the internet so I would have topical stuff to pitch at the Ferguson table. So the point is, it forced me to not dally. It forced me to, the greatest thing that came out of that whole process is it opened me as a writer to being more instinctive, to trust my instincts, because I didn't have the luxury of saying, I'm going to take the weekend to think about this. Should I go this way or that way? No. If the idea comes, run with it and see where it goes.
You know, I think people who produce that's like a very common sort of trait. Like, you just learn to get things done and get it out the door and keep moving, right? And people who don't tend to spend a lot of time. I don't know that spending a lot of time actually helps. Do you like, you know, does it make it better if you'd had like another year to write that book, for example? Yeah. Would that have made it better?
No, I mean, Stephen King has always said that, you know, he thinks 16 weeks is a good window to start and finish a book. I've done that and faster. I like a little bit more of a little flex. You know, when I was living on that treadmill of the Ferguson show and writing the books, I said to myself when I would like collapse on the weekend and give myself an hour, I can do this on a mission. I can't live my life this way. Right. And so the best of all worlds was when I was on Nurse Jackie, when we would have a 6 or 7 month pre-production and shooting schedule. And then I would therefore have 5 months or four, depending on how it worked out, of my own to write a book. So I'd keep writing Castle books, you know, when I was doing that show too. But I had my own governance. I didn't have to do other things during the day.
When you're at this like frenetic schedule, obviously it causes stress, right? Like you can't get sick. You can't, things can't happen. It's because you have to produce day in and day out. How do you handle the stress of that like performance level? Because you see it with like elite athletes, right? You see it for people who are at the top of their game, like just like what you were doing. What were the tools you use that might be helpful to other writers?
Consciously, I run. And as a runner yourself, you know what that's like. The right brain goes and you just kind of, oh, okay, it's okay. And even if it's hugely stressful, you come back and you feel, okay, it's going to be okay. And the other thing is I meditate. I do take 20 minutes every day, no matter what, to just sit and just get into that place and keep my perspective. I often say to myself, because there have been some crushing deadlines. There's nothing worse than having a turkey go to the stage and everybody knows it stinks and you wrote it. And so now you got to fix it. You know, that's a lot of pressure. But you have to say to yourself, both words start with a W, but, you know, worry isn't writing. You know, you got to write. The secret to writing is writing. Right.
Yeah, that's fantastic. When you mentioned the sketches, when you had those sketches ideas and you're trying to avoid the turkey getting to the stage, did the sketch ideas come out as, you know, we're going to do a Prince Charles thing? Did it come out as a situation, or we're going to do Prince Charles in this situation? Or like what was the coal that you would later flame, you know, of?
It would vary. You know, a lot of times it was who we had as a guest. Like Willie Nelson was on the show once and he agreed to be a gardener. And so, so it became all about his garden. And guess what? It was all marijuana. You know what I mean? It was
of course.
And, you know, we had Salman Rushdie on once and he wanted to do he was very funny. He wanted to do a party at Elton John's and there's Salman Rushdie there and all that. And Craig would be Elton John and it was pretty funny. We did a lot of Harry Potter stuff, but it would really just be either topical or mostly it would be like we would be constantly trying to think of, well, what if we did this or what if we did that? And I got to be in him a couple times. I got to be Dumbledore. And the fun of that is that, you know, you're in front of the audience and Craig was Harry Potter. And I grabbed his broom and I just started trying to like brush him away. And so like, he's back against this. He didn't know I was going to do that, but you know, you can have fun with it too. So it's the thrill of live television, actually.
You've had such a really cool career of all these different types of writing. Is there one that you enjoyed more than the others, or are they all so different that you're just in a different space?
You know, I like the solitude and self-governance of being a novelist. But I also love the collaboration and deadline pressure and the excitement of doing television and having it seen all, you know, by, you know, hopefully millions of people, you know, hours later. So, and I guess I would say that that's why the best of all worlds for me was when I had a steady job in television and then a nice fat break after. So I got the best of both worlds.
Do you miss the television?
Well, I do sometimes, but you know, the Accidental Joe is in development now to be a series. And so I've been spending, you know, we're with a major Hollywood studio, as they like to say. And so we expect to be pitching in the next month or so, actually. We got the pitch set. We get casting ideas and all that. So we're going to take it out and see if Mr. and Mrs. Netflix and Hulu and Hoodoo and all that are interested.
That's so exciting. Congratulations. First of all, I mean, it's the perfect setup for a show, right? It could run forever.
And the book would be the first season. And so now I've developed like two or three seasons beyond that, not as deeply as the book, but just enough to tell them that we think we know what we're doing.
So, you know, a lot of the writers that I've talked to have had their work adapted. And is there a different dynamic when you're taking a book that you've written, like you said, the solitude, and it's all inside you, but now it's out there and you've got all the notes and the input and everybody else, and, you know, and it's changing. Like, how do you handle that as the writer? Because that's very different than if you just come in and written the script yourself.
It is. David Mamet had a great quote, which he said, if you're going to adapt a book, read it once, put it in a drawer, and write what you remember. And so that's kind of what my approach is to this, although I will say to you that in the number of meetings that I've had about the book, including ones, people who almost bought it but didn't, or did, you know, made an offer but we took someone else or whatever, it twists a lot when you hear somebody say, well, you know, here's what I think you should do. Mm-hmm. And I actually had somebody say to me, I think it's important that we know why you are the only person who can write this show. And I swear to God, I had to step on my temper, but I said, how about I wrote the effing book?
That seems like a compelling argument to me.
Yeah,
yes.
I know. It's like, but that's
you've
like,
created this.
But you know, it isn't really against them. They have ideas too. And I think it's very important in collaboration to recognize that people who make comments that go up your wazoo aren't trying to harm the project. They're doing their best. The anecdote I would draw is I was directing a sketch on the Late Late Show, and it was a complicated one. It was a Ford commercial that was supposed to be a sketch, but we were on one of the big stages at CBS, and I was the director, and Craig was here, and I said, okay, we're under the gun on time. And I said, okay, we got to clear the set. We got to start shooting. And Craig put his hand on my shoulder and he said, all these people are here trying to help you.
You know, that is just such a great mindset to go in, because you do get wrapped up, right? Especially as a writer, because you care about, you've created this. So it's like a child, you care about it so much. Have there been times when you had notes that at first kind of rubbed you the wrong way, and then later you realized it was better because of them?
I hate that. It happens a lot. No, seriously. I mean, I have this whole thing, and it's not uncommon, is like when I get an email or something, oh, there's more notes from my producing partners. And I go, I don't even want to open it. It's Friday night. Screw it. I want to have a weekend. And my wife always has to remind me, you know, Tom, you always say that, and then you look at the notes and you say they aren't so bad. Or they're good. So I'll go into the office and what do you know? They aren't so bad. You know, so you have to kind of get away from the knee-jerk protectionist shell, I guess.
So is the takeaway there, like take a moment, let it sit, come back to it?
Yes. And also even a note you object to or think isn't good can lead to an improvement. And so it might make you think of something that you didn't think of before. And I've said this recently to somebody who I'm working with, that I will accept any note except anything that's fatal to the concept, you know.
Oh, that's great. Of course. You know, I've talked to a few people who are in development now just recently, and are there any tips that you have because of your extensive experience here for pitching or for getting a book adapted, or it seems like the industry's changed a lot in the last couple of years.
Yeah, it has. It's interesting because there are so many more outlets and it's much more difficult to get a show made. And I think the only thing I could say is basically what we've been talking about here. And, you know, your questions are so astute because they run right to that whole thing, is stay true to what you believe in. Yes, you do need the team to get you there, but at the same time, be careful of mission drift. Don't let things happen that suddenly, you know, the old thing about, you know, a camel is a horse designed by a committee. You don't want that, you know. So don't be petulant. I mean, some people are, and they do very well being petulant. I'm a collaborator. Mm-hmm. So I would say collaborate, but also make sure that what's in you, what made you want to do this stays in.
What was that ability to collaborate? Cause I know writers who can't do this, right? Was that something you were born with that maybe had you go towards television and in some of these more collaborative environments, or was it something you just learned by having to survive to survive in Hollywood?
I will say this: middle child of a dysfunctional family. And seriously,
there you go. Yep.
You know what I mean? So like I was a peacemaker and I was like, let's step back here. You know, I would that had as much to do with it as anything. That was stuff I applied to television. Now I did learn lessons and fine points and, you know, how not to say the wrong thing at a cast meeting and things like that. But I would say that if you recognize what you've bought, buy in. You know, don't get mad at what you read to do.
You know, it's really insightful that you see that from how you grew up, because I read a study about a year ago and it was lining up careers with a birth order. And it was so interesting how a first child tends to do different things, and you know, as you go down the list.
It's a hard book to find. I know this because I searched for it in the 90s, but there is a book by John Cleese, and it was called Families and How to Survive Them. And it was a book he co-wrote with a shrink in Britain. And it's all about that family dynamic. And not only was it insightful in terms of my own personal situation, but it's not a bad roadmap for casting a show and how to figure out who the characters are. And, you know, there's always the scapegoat. And then there's the aggressor. There's the bully. There's the timid one. You know, it becomes archetypes. And they're archetypes for a reason. Again, back to universality.
That's a wonderful tip. So do you do that when you're populating a novel or a script? Do you start with the archetypes? Okay, we need an ally here. I need a mentor, whatever it may be.
Yeah, and very important and often overlooked is a confidant. It's very important to have a confidant. How many lesser books have you read where you're reading along and you're supposed to know something, but you don't know because the author hasn't told you what to know. It's like supplying a punchline without the setup in a joke. You got to know what the rules are. And, you know, there's a lot of writers get so cute or that they are so close to it, they don't recognize that they need to be a little plain now and again.
When you're talking about like a stand-in for the reader or somebody who's able to like explain and communicate, when you did The Accidental Joe, is sort of an amateur sleuth, right? Like in that respect, did that allow you, was that a vehicle for you to be able to explain things that otherwise like two, say, seasoned espionage agents wouldn't talk about?
Absolutely, because he screws up a lot. And also he has to take orders from his producer, you know, and so he loves her, but she has to say, no, you don't do that. And I want you to do this and don't do anything else. But, and then of course he goes and does what he's going to do because he doesn't follow rules very well. But it's a wonderful, if you want to get out exposition, I think the best ways to do it are two people have an argument, because in an argument you say things that are bald. You say, wait a minute, you're the one who said, you know, so it doesn't quite seem so. And the other thing is put a stranger in there, somebody who doesn't know. Okay, so, you know, you can't put your hand in the snowblower while it's running, because if you do, you know what I mean? It's like what might be obvious to many needs to be explained to the neophyte.
I have to ask you one, because you're giving such great tips for, and we have a lot of writers who watch the podcast. Because you are so prolific, are there any tools for developing writing habit that you've used? Because, I mean, you're a runner, right? You're doing all these different things. You're meditating every day. So clearly you've learned how to be disciplined. How would you recommend a writer goes about creating a writing practice?
Right. Well, I think it would depend on the person, because everybody's got, I mean, there are some great TV writers I know who would write the whole episode Sunday night before the Monday table reading. You know what I mean? And they were great. So I don't want to, but my whole thing is treat it like a job. Regular hours, you know, the Picasso line is that inspiration comes, but it has to find you working. And I think there's a lot to be said for habitual, you know, 8 a.m. coffee, 9 a.m. in the chair. And I go sometimes till 7 at night. You know, I love writing. So now it doesn't mean it's all writing. Some of it is just thinking like that. But that's writing too, I guess.
Sure. Be
technical about it. But yeah, I think suit it to what is productive for you. Some people just go by a word count. Okay, I'm going to write 400 pages, 400 words, or I mean, that's Walter Mosley. And I'm thinking, Walter Mosley only writes 400 words a day? You know, but they're good words, right?
And it adds up. Yeah, right, writing some words. I had a Lyft driver this morning who was talking about how she has all these ideas, but she hasn't pulled the trigger in years. She just got out of that habit of writing. It's really interesting.
Yeah, and you're hitting on something that is very important. I in TV, I had writing partner attempts early on, because that uses the big thing. You know, so it's Babalu Mandel and Lowell Ganz, you know, and they're doing this movie. So I had a couple, when I was breaking in, I had a couple writers who wanted to pair, and we tried. And what I found is they weren't productive. And one of them just was lazy and just wouldn't work. And then the other one was brilliant, but like I was living in Santa Monica and he was living near the further in Santa Monica. So I would ride my bike to his apartment and we'd write. And we'd have a great day of writing. I'd come back home, and this is in the age of answering machines. By the time I rode home on my bike, I'd come in my house and I'd hit the answering machine, and it's him unraveling everything we did that day.
Oh.
Yeah, I don't think we can do that. And so I decided, you know what? It's important to be productive. Don't be writer-ish. Don't do the pose. Put words on paper. Get stuff done.
You know, you mentioned how everybody's different, and it's true, right? People write in very different ways and they use different tools. But the one metric I always tell people is if you don't fall back on that, if you're not creating, if you're not producing, then it's not working for you.
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly right. And if it's not working, keep going, because you can fix it. Yeah. And, you know, worst case scenario, it's a dud. Oh, well. But I learned something.
The Accidental Joe is just fantastic. I really encourage people to go out and pick that up. What, other than working on this new movie or series that's coming out, yeah, what are you working on?
I have a standalone that I'm editing now. I finished my first draft right a week before Christmas, went all through the house. Not a creature is stirring. And so I began my edit of that last week. And, you know, I have to squeeze 50 pages out of it, which I've actually gotten 40 out, so that's okay. It's a spy book. It's a standalone. It could be a series, I suppose, but it's not another Accidental Joe.
Well, we love to have you come on when that book comes out, because there's about a million questions I would like to ask you that we haven't talked about yet.
I want to tell you, Jeff, that this is you and I sat at that table signing books in Fredericksburg and had a wonderful conversation. If those damn people wouldn't come up and want to buy the book, we would have had a great time. But when you said you wanted to invite me on, I had such anticipation and hope, and I have to say it goes beyond the expectations. It's been such a wonderful time.
Oh, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. It means a lot coming from you. Yeah. Where should the viewers go to find your work?
You mean like viewers like, oh, viewers of this. I thought you said, well, I don't have anything.
You have TomStraw.com. Do you want them to go to Amazon? Where should they go buy this book?
Yeah, this is where I fall down, is like the point of sale, you know, closing is always. You would like to go to TomStraw.com. And, you know, my books are available on Amazon. And I like to say in small quantities at better at books in bookstores, larger quantities in not so good bookstores.
That's fantastic. So this has been a real pleasure, Tom. I always tell viewers before when we're closing out here, go get this book, but leave a review for him on Amazon. These reviews definitely help and they draw people to that. And if you are enjoying this podcast and you like what we're doing with Elaine's Literary Salon, please follow us, elainesliterarysalon.com, and leave a review for us as well. Thomas has been just wonderful. I want you to come back if you can when the new book comes out.
And next time in person.
Yes, we'd love to have you here. We get a great crowd here, and it's so much fun to do it in person and have a drink while you're doing it.
I'll be happy to do that. I'll be happy to drink during.
Well, listen, good luck, and let us know what happens with this series. I think it could be a huge hit.
All right, Jeff. Thank you very much. I really, really had a good time.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Take care.